Anthropomorphism. If someone were asked, how did Babylonians represent their deities? The most accurate answer you could give is anthropomorphically. Now, that may not strike you as being important or perhaps even significant, but in the times where they lived, in the context of the ancient Near East, if we didn't know better, we would not necessarily expect it. But you all know from having sat through most of the six sessions we've had that the dominant way in which the Babylonians portrayed their great gods, the chief deities, the powers of the universe, the rulers within nature, was in human form. Now, the word anthropos, when you use it in combinations like this, does not mean male. It means human. And yet when we say that about the Mesopotamian deities, we ask ourselves, what does that mean? Well, I remember comments that you all have been making along the way, better than I remember some of what I've said, and some of your reactions to the portrayals of the deities and humans and the relations have reflected the fact that you saw, for instance, in Hammurabi standing in front of Shamash, a real close relationship. And that's one of the first things that anthropomorphism means. It means that you're talking about a relationship between people or beings who are like one another. Now, to flip that around, go backwards, one of the things that has struck me in recent years in America is the anthropomorphic way in which people relate to their pets. They talk about the pets, when they see certain behavior in the pets, they interpret it in human terms. Because part of that is because of the close relationship. So one of the first things that anthropomorphism means is you're talking about relationship of like beings. And so basic to Mesopotamian theology is the portrayal of the deities in human terms. Now, what are the alternatives? Well, the alternatives are to present them in animal form, for instance, which was a dominant tradition in Egypt, where you have gods presented like falcons, cows, bulls. And when you do that, when humans do that, they're moving the gods farther away from themselves in terms of their conceptions of how they understand themselves in relationship to deities. But likeness does not mean identity, does not mean they are the same. Because we have noticed, well, let's say, what kinds of differences between humans and the deities have you noticed as we have been looking at these various portraits and listening also to some of the things I've read you? What are some of the differences? Whatever differences. How about size? Most of the time. In one particular portrayal of the Assyrian king with seven deities in between his two pictures, they're about the same. If you take the animals out from under the gods, they're all about the same. That's unusual. That's not typical. What about their dress? Dress the same or different? Ah, yes. No human with ever a horn crown. And you can see the deities in their relative ranks by that. That's right. That's correct. What about weapons or tools or implements that they have? The ring and the rod, only, and in fact, that is not held by all deities, but only by the high one. Big seven, whatever the number happened to be at the time. The scimitar, for instance. We showed you one exceptional picture of a human king holding it, but most of the time that's a deity's possession. It's a mark of the deity's action and activity. What about gestures? Since we are studying art, which operates primarily apart from words, what about the gestures that the humans and the deities have been displaying in these various pictures? Don't worry about being right or wrong, because that's more comprehensive, just trying to see what are these that you remember. We've looked at a lot, I know. Some of them haven't been that clear. Kind of typical stance for king is one hand up and the other one like this. Sometimes they have both hands up. What about the deities? When I ask that question, you have to distinguish between a high deity that's shown and some interceding personal gods or goddesses. Sitting. Humans don't sit in the presence of the deities, do they? We haven't seen it. And their stance is usually pretty attentive, eye to arm. The supplicant deities, the ones who seem to be presenting humans to high god, often have their hands up like this, but the high gods don't do that. And extending the rod and ring, holding it just out of reach. Very cute trick. Reminds me of tricks my granddaughter plays on. Okay, so when we talk about anthropomorphism, we're talking about a way of presenting the relationship with likeness and kind of common ground, and yet distinction, difference. And it's very important to observe that those distinctions are maintained through all the changes and all that we've seen. It is very hard in most any of these pictures to confuse a deity with a human. And there's hardly any. There are some rare instances where people say that a deity is being presented as an animal, but at best those are exceptions. The dominant one is that human, big, idealized, powerful human presentation with dignity. And, well, what kind of symbols we had? Lots of symbols. We've already mentioned the rod and the ring, and I mentioned the scimitar. The what? The crescent, right? The eight-pointed star. That's right. Pardon? A spade, yes. Very important. Martin spade. Plow for the sun god. A lot of them. Which? The wedge for the moon god. Yes, the writing instrument. Styli. And in those portraits, we have not seen people in possession of those. Kind of division function going on. Which of the gods have we seen grouped together, either in anthropomorphic figures in the same presentation or in symbols grouped together? Sun and the moon. Who else is usually there?
Ishtar.
Venus. Ishtar. Also later known as Aphrodite. rear, top of presentation, part of his representative at all in some other way. Now, way back when we started, the second night, we talked about names. And the God names that occur in human names, which are generally sentences, either with or without a verb. And that gives us a clue to loyalties, dedications, commitments, and all the rest by virtue of looking at those. Now, the one thing we have not talked much about, and I want to state this, describe just briefly, is that very often what has been under the feet of these major deities? And what kind, Ben? Composite animals, quite often. Also lions look like lions, horses that look like horses, bulls look like bulls. But we have that funny one that Marduk has around a lot of times, a lizard with cow horns and strange feet, big long tail like a scorpion. What other ones have we had, any? What else beside those have been under the feet of deities? Mountains. Shamash, the sun god who comes up over them. Water, under Marduk, usually because he conquered the waters of chaos. Water, sea especially, is very often symbol for unrest, chaos, threat. Not only in Babylonia, but in the Old Testament. Now, we're going to see a few more of these animals tonight. I want you to notice something about them, because since they are not explained anywhere in the document, you know, the documents help us to understand how people viewed the gods, because when they prayed to them, they prayed in a certain way, a certain title and stuff. But it's very hard to track down these animals that are under the feet of the deities, either being put down with one foot, stood on like a mount with 2 feet, like a trick rider, like a rodeo, held on a rope, or when the god is sitting, portrayed on the side of a chair, on the side of. Many people have, when these things were first being discovered, said, aha, those stand for the forces of evil that have been conquered by these gods. And people saw in it a kind of evolution from animism, the endowing of everything in nature with a spirit, and most of them malevolent spirits, threatening spirits. And then the conquest of these by these gods of order and regulations who make cosmos chaos. And cosmos, remember, is derived from the same Greek word as our word cosmetics. It is to bring beauty, order to something, but not necessarily that way by itself. But that interpretation is long ago fallen into disuse. It was questioned, you know, and then argued about, and then a lot of research was done on it. And people noticed, for instance, when you look at those animals, that it's hard to find one where it looks angry or threatened. They look docile. They're usually in a position of subservience. And the general interpretation that prevails today, it could change with more data, of course, is that these are understood to be the servants, the animalized presentation of servants of the deity, and may in fact be forms that were represented on charms and other things that were used to ward off evil, rather than themselves to be symbols of subdued evil, to be rather symbols of blessing good Now, I hope you notice the tentative way in which I put that, because I'm not sure any of those theories accounts for the way they look to me. And I suppose that's the way most of us judge things, is does that convince me? I'm a little unconvinced about that, but that's a very brief review of how those have been treated. They are very important, apparently, because they're always around. And then you remember, as we'll see tonight again on the Ishtar Gate, you have beautifully portrayed as guardians, apparently, take over, being at the place where the gate is guarded, also by humans as well as by them. The last time we looked at Ishtar, and I think you gained some distinct impressions of the manner in which she was presented, particularly later on in the period in which my interest focuses. And coming from that period, I want to read you a lamentation to Ishtar. Remember, the lamentation seems to have behind it two things. One, the belief that appealing to a deity will make a significant difference in a bad situation. And two, it presumes a bad situation. You cold? No. Oh. I didn't know whether you were cold or warm. And I mentioned also that the personal lamentation is the most frequent form of psalm that we have in the 150 psalms of the Old Testament. And it begins usually with an address to the God, identifying God, a description of the plight, appeal for help, sometimes a real complaint that this isn't the first time I asked for help and how long is this going to go on. In fact, some people, I remember one time studying some complaints and asking people how they responded to that and what they thought it meant, that we really don't do that much anymore in the Christian church. People very seldom get together and go through a liturgy of lamentation, really complaining to God and saying, where are you when I need you? Before he caught himself, one minister who was there said in front of his laity, "You shouldn't talk to God that way." I said, "Maybe not." But they sure thought that was a way to talk to him in the Old Testament. And Jesus did too. My God, why have you forsaken me? That comes from the Psalm. Jesus appropriated that. We have lamentations similar to those in Acadian. We read one the other night. It's addressed to Mark. This one is addressed to Kishtar. By going at this the way we have, by singling out individual deities, describing them, focusing on them, we may have been misleading ourselves, or I may have been misleading you into thinking that the organization of the pantheon had very clear-cut departments, like a very well-organized bureaucracy. But when you turn to the prayers and hymns in Babylon, the impression you get is the one who is praying is suddenly ascribing to the deity addressed almost all the functions of all the major deities, the great powerful ones, while focusing on the peculiar and particular and unique affirmations attached to that deity. Listen to this lament to Ishtar from the 6th century. "I pray to thee, O Lady of Ladies, Goddess of Goddesses, O Ishtar, Queen of all peoples, who guides mankind aright, O Ishtar, ever exalted, greatest of the gods, O mighty of princesses, exalted is thy name. Thou indeed art the light of heaven and earth, O valiant daughter of Sin. O supporter of arms who determines battle, O possessor of all divine power, who wears the crown of dominion, O Lady, glorious is thy greatness. Over all the gods is exalted, not only over humans, but the gods. O Star of Lamentations, who causes peaceable brothers to fight, yet who constantly gives friendship. O Mighty One, Lady of Battle, who suppresses the mountains, remember the role in helping Chamosh come up over the mountains. O Ishtar, the one covered with fighting and clothed with terror, thou dost make complete judgment and decision the ordinances of heaven and earth. Chapels, holy places, sacred sites, and shrines pay heed to thee. Where is not thy name? Where is not thy divine power? Where are thy likenesses not fashioned? Where are thy shrines not founded? Where art thou not great? Where art thou not exalted? Anu, Enlil, and Ea, earlier, three most powerful deities, made thee high among the gods. They caused thy dominion to be great. They have made thee high among all the gods. They have made thy position preeminent. At the thought of thy name, heaven and earth tremble, the gods stand in awe. To thy awesome name, mankind must pay heed. Thy mercy, O Lady of Heaven and Earth, Shepherdess of the weary people. Thy mercy, O Lady of the Holy Temple, the pure storehouse. Thy mercy, O Lady, unwearied are thy feet, swift are thy knees. Thy mercy, O Lady of conflict and of all battles. O Shining One, Lioness the gods, subduer of angry gods, most powerful of all princes, who holdest the reins of kings, but who dost release the bridles of all maidservants, who art exalted and firmly fixed, O valiant Ishtar, great is thy might. O brilliant one, torch of heaven, light of all people. O unequaled angry one of the fight, strong one of the battle, O firebrand which is kindled against the enemy, which brings about the destruction of the furious, O gleaming one Ishtar, assembler of the host, O deity of men, goddess of women, whose designs no one can conceive, where thou dost look, one who is dead lives, one who is sick rises up. The erring one who sees thy face goes right. I have cried to thee, suffering, weary, and distressed, as thy servant. See me, O my lady, accept my prayer. Faithfully look upon me and hear my supplication. Promise my forgiveness and let thy spirit be appeased. Pity for my wretched body, which is full of confusion and trouble. Pity for my sickened heart, which is full of tears and sufferings. Pity for my wretched intestines, which are full of confusion and trouble. Pity for the afflicted house, which mourns bitterly. Pity for my feelings, which are satiated in tears and suffering. It goes on to describe light. How long, O Lady, wilt thou be angered so that thy face is turned away? How long, O my Lady, wilt thou be infuriated so that thy spirit is enraged? Turn thy neck which thou hast set against me. Set thy face toward good favor. Like the water of the opening up of a canal, let thy emotions be released. My foes like the ground, let me trample Subdue my haters and cause them to crouch down under me. Let my prayers and supplications come to thee. Let thy mercy be upon me. Let those who see me in the street magnify thy name before all humans, saying, Ishtar indeed is exalted. Ishtar indeed is queen. The lady indeed is exalted. The lady indeed is queen. Ishtar, the valorous daughter of Sin, has no rival. Now the big four in Babylon at the time of the 6th century of Marduk, who had brought order out of chaos and put the sun, the moon, and Ishtar into the heavens to regulate the calendar, to show people that it was the appropriate time to do their duties, their agricultural activities, as well as the feasts and festivals which belonged to the temple establishment. And the sun and the moon and Ishtar, together with Marduk, are the high gods of the heavens. In this period of time that I'm interested in, the 6th century BC, the other three deities who are not as important, but who appear with frequency and seem to have important functions, are first of all two foreigners. The first of them, Amuru, A-M-U-R-R-U, is a god who apparently originated up in this area with the people whom folks of early Babylon, back at the time of Hammurabi, called Amorites, Westerners. Now, that means somehow that they regarded them as coming in from over here. And their god is Amuru. I'm going to look at some portraits of him. But before we do, I want to point out that the Egyptians, quite often during the second millennium BC, called all of Syria-Palestine the land of Amuru. One of the hypotheses that operates in our interpretation of this part of the world is that in the 1800s and the 1700s BC, the Amorites, whose language we now know from the discoveries at Mari in the 18th and 17th centuries, became very powerful and very influential through this entire area. And though their importance as an identifiable people did not last that long, one of the things they left behind was Amuru, who became part, from time to time, became an important part of the Babylonian pantheon. Way back when we were first talking about the 6th century BC, I mentioned the word Chaldeans and said that the Neo-Babylonian rulers from 625 BC to 539 BC in Babylon were Chaldeans, Aramaic-speaking people who took over and, honoring the great Babylonian traditions, became the last representatives of the Babylonian cultural tradition here. Before that, I mentioned that they are known to us from about 875 BC as people at home down in this area, down where all the swamps and the lakes are, who also were opponents of Assyrian power. And we know them first because of the Assyrian problems with them. one of the groups of allies which they had in opposing Assyrian control were the Arameans, another group of people who also spoke Aramaic. And the Arameans are people who, similar to the Amorites, come from up in this area. Aram, A-R-A-M, is in this area, sometimes moved coming down as far as Damascus and down in here. These people are first identified in the Babylonian records around 1170 BC and continue to be mentioned in various connections down into the period in which we are focusing. These people also contributed a deity to the pantheon of Babylon, namely Adad, who is also known as Hadad, and is best known in the Old Testament under his title Baal, B-A-A-L. Baal Hadad would be a full name. And this Adad is a storm deity. Now remember that from he still figures in the period in which we're interested in, but he's kind of off stage somewhere and just gets mentioned by the by. And in fact, occasionally gets credit for sending bad things to people along with Anu. But the god who fills the function of the storm deity during this period is Adad. So when we talk, after we get through Marduk, Nabus, Shamash, and Ishtar, the next two gods at this time that are most important, both came in from outside. They were not indigenous gods, but the gods who came in from outside and took over the functions previously belonging to other gods. Although I, for one, don't know whose functions Amuru took over because of the peculiar functions that he had. So we'll look at those. There he is. Pointed cap. A crook. Shepherd's crook. Foot on a goat. Not dressed like other deities of the time in this early picture. Associated with them, however, because here's Ishtar's star and the crescent and the sun and all. And in his hand, he has a staff which is holding up the crescent. So we're not talking about monotheism. We're talking about a pantheon in which fluidity and some merging of functions and functions moving back from one to the other and shifting of functions and names is very common. Now, the distinguishing feature, the distinguishing symbol by which you can identify Amuru and should be able to find him in these pictures to which I am presently too close, is the shepherd's crook and under his foot a goat, and sometimes associated with him is a dog. I don't know, I haven't found any discussion, but I would assume that the dog is a sheepdog. A dog used in shepherding. And Amuru is presented in the portraits of him as one associated with shepherding, particularly with, in this case, with goats, the herding of goats. Now, do you see him anywhere in here? get close to those things, you can't see them. Let's look at another one. Here's the one we were just, this one's very similar to the one we were just looking at, with the shepherd's crook right here, the animal under his foot. You see him anywhere else in there? Crooks, right up, shepherd's crooks right up here. This is probably him. That looks like a crook right there. Not, you know what I mean by crook. Big cane or collar, you know.
Is that one right? The third one from the bottom?
This one?
Yeah.
I'm too close to you. You're probably too far away.
It looks like it's moving along the steps.
There he is again, right behind him is a crook. Oftentimes he's with a consort, a female counterpart, who also has a shepherd's crook. This is clearer. See him in there anywhere? See the crook, and in the other hand, he's got some kind of a whip or
sling.
What?
Sling.
Some maybe a sling. That does look like a sling at some end. Here's a goat under his foot. How important would a god be in Babylon, a god whose functions have to do with the raising of sheep and goats? Yeah. Essential. And yet the one we know is a god from a foreign background. And one of the indications of his foreign background is, best of my knowledge, we aren't ever told whose brother he is, whose father he is, whose son he is. He lacks a genealogy, which many of the others have. And in looking around through the text to find places where he is mentioned, it's very difficult to find him. And one of the reasons is because his name and the name of his land are identical. And it's not all, and you need to be very sure that you're not finding just the name of the land of Amuru rather than the name of the deity. Very close relationship between Amuru and his functions and the land of Syria, Palestine. This part of the world where one might get the impression that the sheep and the goats had been around for a while.
Was Amuru god called as Amuru also by Amorites?
Yes. Answer that. All right. So I'm not going to read you anything about him. I'm going to hold this up for a minute. This copy on the right, we've seen Marduk in this picture many times before. The one on the right is a similar presentation of Adad with this costume not unlike Marduk's, quite a different kind of beard, different kind of hairdo. And if I had taken the picture better, you could see what he had in his other hand. But you can see something up there that looks like a weapon or something, maybe for driving animals away from the sheep. All right. The other god, the one who took over Enlil's functions, is the god Adad. And when you look for him, look for a three-pronged fork. Lightning bolts. And a bull. Do you see him anywhere in there?
I lost my eyeglasses, I guess.
Pardon?
I lost my distance eyeglasses.
Oh. Sometimes he's on a dragon. Now here's a good picture of him on a young bull. Right here with a fork, like a trident, like the ones you see with the,
Poseidon.
What's the Roman god of the sea?
Poseidon.
Neptune, Poseidon, and not to mention Satan, who is often portrayed that way. There he is right there. Kind of typical picture of him, grouped together with other deities and under other symbols. You see any others like that? Here's just the symbol of the fork. Here he is again. Notice the conical cap that's different from the caps of most of the other deities except for Amuru. There's a certain relationship. Has something that looks like a throwing stick in the other hand in this picture. And then the three-pronged lightning. Here he is again. Right up here.
What's he have his foot on?
In that case.
Basketball.
Looks like it's about to kick off in a basketball game, doesn't it? Like Mr. Mondale the other day talked about the big inning in a football game, mixing his imagery. Okay, let's see if we got him over here. There's a picture of him. Now, if you could see these pictures really clearly, one of the things you discover about him, and not surprisingly, is that the Babylonians were ambivalent about the storm god, because not only did he bring rain, he brought hail and wind and lightning, and so he was both a god to be hoped for and feared at the same time. So there was a little bit of ambivalence about him. I don't see. Well, here he is. This is an early picture of Enlil, actually, but not an unusual way to show Hadad either, with his lightning bolts up here and riding in a chariot. It is not uncommon at all to talk about the storm god as riding in the chariot of clouds. If you were watching to the west this afternoon, you would see how one could develop that imagery, the way the clouds roll and roil when a storm is coming. In fact, that terminology is used of God in the Old Testament, called the rider of the clouds. And the word rider there means chariot rider, not just any kind of rider. Now this naked goddess here, notice, is on top of a composite lion. It looks like he has an upset stomach, but he also has wings. One of the curious things about these winged animals is that they never fly, they just have wings. But she has lightning bolts in her hand. Some people think that's Ishtar. But as I mentioned the other day, though she is reputed to have been the goddess of sexual love, looking for portraits of her that unambiguously present that is not easy. More frequently, she's presented quite clearly as the goddess of hostility and war. Here's a picture of Ishtar and Adad with a king before them. You notice here's a picture of Adad holding the ring, dressed very much like Ishtar, who is here only, she's kind of light infantry today because all she has is a bow and the ring. Above them, the wedge of Marduk, the stylus of Nabu, the crescent, and that's scored there. What else do they have? See the almost stylized tiny lightning fork right here? Lightning bolt right there. Notice how similar his beard is to the one we looked at in that sketch just a few minutes ago. His feathered crown is one we've seen before on a lot of the high gods. It comes from a period between 1500 and 1300 BC. That style of crown originates at that time and carries on from there on. Now, in this particular picture, which you've seen before, of the procession, procession of the gods during Assyrian times, here he is back here, riding on two bulls with his lightning bolts in his hand as one of the seven high gods. Here we got two women, remember, Ishtar twice, and Marduk and others. Now, up in the area which is more his home territory, up near Syria, this inscription comes from, and whoops, going. Every once in a while, this thing doesn't go the right direction. Sun disk above him, same kind of beard and long hair, lightning bolts in this case, both hands, sword, aggressive stance, one that nobody could maintain on top of a bull for more than a short time. But this is a typical at-home representation of the storm god Adad, Kadad, who becomes known as Baal, the Lord of Syria and Palestine in later period. Now, here are some of the composite animals. This one is not composite, it's just a good looking representation of a lion. And this is the particular a dragon that's associated with Marduk, a lizard-like face with big horns sticking up, a scorpion's tail, and two different kinds of claws. This is the way they appear on this reconstruction of the Ishtar Gate. This is the one that the Marduk procession had to go out through to, for the New Year's festival. And this one, whoops. Oh, yeah. I don't mind this running off. I wanted to show you what that lizard-like thing. See the chicken-type feet? And lion-type feet on a lizard body with a scorpion tail and bull horn. What's that?
The back feet are raccoon and bird.
Predator, aren't they? Predatorial birds?
Yeah.
And this is just a fine looking bull. On that same set of buildings, you have these beautiful stylized palm trees, which we've been seeing from the very early times as a symbol of the basic agricultural for which these gods existed. Now, you've seen this one before. It's one of those kuduro, or land grant markers, which we have the symbols of deities up here. Notice again, with associated in three cases with composite animals. I forget what that one is. What's that with a curved horn? Some kind of a sheep, isn't it?
Ibex.
Ibex. Now, I'm going to go slowly through the next few pictures without any comment. What I want to tell you about them is, most of the pictures we've been looking at are earlier than the period that I've been trying to focus attention on. Anthropomorphic representation. No, look at these next ones. Particularly same picture, but different slide. I wanted to see which one was better, and I couldn't tell without projecting. If there's a tendency in that, what is it you notice? Some of that? Pardon? A lot more animals. Where are the god figures? If we had side-by-side projection, what I'd like to do right at this point is cut that in half, let you look at that, and put Hammurabi and Shamash on this side, and say, what has happened to the relationship between humans and deities in 1200 years? That's where we're going to pick up Wednesday night. And the question is, what does it mean that during the last Babylonian period, that so much of the art represents the presence of the deities only by the symbols and not by the anthropomorphic presentation? So Wednesday night, we're going to hand out a summary of what we've done with some suggestions about reading and discuss with you that question as one that I think can help us to get inside and understand within the limits of the distance between us and them something of what was going on in the 6th century B.C. in human understanding of the world in Babylon.
Is this much, this latest period?
This is the Neo-Babylonian period. This is the 6th century BC. And this is typical.
They symbolize the gods,
yes,
instead of a human form.
One god there was all the horns and
the star. But you know, if you go back to this previous, whoops, can't get it to back up. What does it mean, this shift to so much symbolism over against the consistent anthropomorphic representation of deities, especially when the representation of the demons against whom humans need help is so graphic?
The world has become wicked.
You think so? Hey, think about that. We'll talk about it Wednesday night. You can turn that light on, Dave.
Russ, I've got a question for you. If I can state it right, it's kind of complicated, but it seems to me you make a very good point about the fact that the representation of the gods in the anthropomorphic form seems to show a closer personal relationship than representation of the gods in a zoomorphic morphological form. Is that right? What you're saying?
Yes.
What does that mean then when you translate that into the Old Testament, where certainly you have the Hebrews speaking about God and writing literarily in anthropomorphic terms, but refusing to represent the deity either as an animal or anthropomorphically, although it seems the closest you get is maybe the Ark of the Covenant, there's the mercy seat, which is a thing which represents the presence of Yahweh. How does that translate?
Well, that's a that's one of the primary questions that I would like to be able to answer. And I think I put it just about the same way you put it, and have been putting it that way, and I'm searching for it. Particularly, for instance, in 2nd Isaiah, who operated in Babylon during the 6th century BC and derogates these deities. At the same time, uses lots of anthropomorphic language, imagery, to describe Yahweh, and thinks he's doing something different. What's the difference with words and picture? Is that what an image is? It's making it so concrete? A portrayal? I don't know the answer yet.
Seems kind of a related thing is the lament of the people in Babylon and how could we worship in the close identification of Yahweh with his temple and without his temple. It seems to me that the popular view was without the temple we really can't worship Yahweh.
Well, then it's more of a lament. You have to come back to
it.
I won't give you an answer because I don't know. I think it's a
you know, I think it's very important. Some people have suggested that verbal statement do not give you the quote control and fixity of the understanding of deity, that artistic portrayal. What I ask you to think I'd like to know why I'm studying, but I don't know yet. There's cookies back there.
Before the course is over, what is the problem of symbols and modules? I remember the, you know, samadhi,
the stage
is a little more. Yes. But he's usually personified.
Personified.
In a big form.
Yes. A lot of the symbols of the celestial gods because it's created.
And so he's the only one who holds the spade. And has four horns.
Sometimes seven.
I wanted to tell you that
four horns are summer. Wasn't he
sometimes.
The spade is the differentiating thing.
That's the distinctive symbol of Marga.
And when does it come in the history of the Marga?
No.
She has a layout.
Yeah. So we've been talking about Babylonia, which took over from the Sumerians.
Yeah. So when does it come in?
Around 2000.
Maybe it's just today we want.
He takes over from Enlil, storm god, giver of kingship. Marga just takes over from him.
So later than the Amorites, they brought the Hadad.
Yeah, you fall asleep.
So Ellen was more of a.
I was very interested in the Bible in the Jerusalem Post.
Before by the
old ones, women and children.
Right.
And when was the epic of creation
now? First childhood education college.
Well, we don't have the earliest form.
They were teaching the children.
We have later form.
You know, they had more children. Look as though
they are rewritten in order to exalt Marga, whereas written so they exalt the
end. But they could teach that.
We don't have the
They was a major contribution.
Yes,
when
was that in this time? So that's the opposite to the written form of
life. Yeah, but
that was the week before.
There are some fragments of earlier ones from there. But as far as knowing how to reconstruct
it, they really had their priorities straight.
And it's Marga's game.
This is
part of this is the portal of Marga's
development. Because they were talking about
stability. When was this epic of creation?
They were saying that in this area, the average
in the
this only leads to abuse.
The library
kingdom.
The which one?
Because, you know,
the one, the vortex of the legislative verse.
Oh,